Accession number 8736, room number 5.
Lord Harding, tape 5.
Well, as I said just now, I think one of the most important things in training is to have experience of what I call living at war. And you can stay awake for hours on end. You can be perfectly capable of functioning for days and nights, for two or three nights anyway, without sleep. But when it comes to weeks and months, then you must be able to organize your work, your activities, in such a way that you get proper sleep, proper food, and generally keep yourself fit, healthy, both in mind and body. And that is something which you don't learn naturally. A countryman is better at it than a townsman, because a countryman is used to living rough and being out in the open all the time, but a townsman, no. And this is something which, when I was commanding, took over the 8th Corps, which was earmarked as one of the overlord assault corps, I arranged an exercise which went on for 10 days for the Corps when I was up in Yorkshire. I didn't stay there to see it through, but it was carried through, and everybody I talked to since said that it was extremely useful, because they were out in the field under active service conditions, without being shot at, but otherwise being in completely active service conditions, for a period in which they couldn't stay awake and be efficient without sleep and without proper food.
And you feel your experience in Gallipoli gave you that initial
idea? Well, that background. That was where I first got to feel, to think about that sort of thing. And then as you go on, further experiences, it just endorsed that, made it more obvious.
Do you think conditions, the living conditions for the men in the field, are very vital?
Oh yes, they're absolutely vital, I think. Oh yes, I mean, if you apply the slogan that an army marches on its stomach to the life of a soldier, day in, day out, in battle or in a campaign, then you get the significance of it all.
Do you belong to the Gallipoli Association?
The what?
The Gallipoli Association.
No, I don't.
Have you heard of it?
I don't know why I don't, but I don't.
Have you heard of it?
Yes, I've heard of it. Yes, I've heard of it, but no, I don't. I may have been asked to join at different times, but I never have. I don't know. I've always, that there are so many things that one belongs to. I mean, your regimental association is the basic one. Well, then there's your divisional association and your corps association. I mean, I was a machine gunner. I started being a machine gunner in Gallipoli, but then later, as time went on, I went into the machine gun corps. I commanded a machine gun company and eventually a machine gun battalion in Palestine, in Syria. And I'm still president of the machine gun corps, Old Comrades Association. And until we stopped it, because we dropped down to about 10 or a dozen, I was president of the Machine Gun Corps Officers Club. Well, that plus regimental, plus divisional, I mean, dinners and meetings and so on. No, you can't do everything.
How vital were machine guns on Gallipoli and your role, you know, as a machine gun?
Well, I would say they were vital, they were important, they were useful in of course, at that time it was purely defensive operations, and they were very useful as a defense firepower, for defensive firepower covering the infantry front. But as the war went on, the use of machine guns and the function of machine guns extended considerably. Because when I went in Sinai, or in Palestine, when I was the divisional machine gun officer of the 54th Division for the third Battle of Gaza, and there we used massed machine guns and produced a machine gun barrage to cover the first assault, and that was done by indirect fire. And so, by that time, not only were they purely defensive, produced defensive firepower, but they produced offensive firepower as well. So yes, no, there was a big role for the machine gun. How effective those machine gun barrages were, I don't know, but they were certainly an essential part. You had for instance, in the attack on Gaza, the third battle. There was the artillery barrage and the machine gun barrage as well. And so that role had turned from a purely defensive one into an offensive one. And then they were used for harassing fire too, when you were entrenched, two lines of trenches facing each other. You used machine guns for harassing fire against the enemy's lines of supply or against his artillery positions and so on. By that time, you've got better, more and more intelligence. I mean, I don't remember in Gallipoli having any real intelligence about the enemy dispositions, the layout of his artillery or anything like that. The only thing I knew about then, when we were in trenches at Anzac, was where its front line was.
I suppose the same could be said for communications generally. That there was a development during the First World War. Did you find that?
Oh, yes, tremendously. Not so much as during the Second World War. During the First World War, we started with flags and lamps in semaphore, and I don't remember in Gallipoli even having any telephones, but there were telephones there, field telephones with wires running along the top of the ground. and then, of course, as the war went on, you got better and more efficient at the use of signaling lamps and flags and heliographs and so on. Well, the heliograph came from the South African War. But we had no radio. But the introduction of radio is what made all the difference in the world to communications. You're not dependent on a wire. And that, of course, even in the Second World War, took a little time to develop. And now you've got satellites. And these are benefits, if you like to call it that way, of advanced technology. You know, the intercommunication within the army has changed and improved more than anything else during the two world wars. And now, in the last 75 years, finding a regiment of tanks without any radio, what would go on? Or if you pictured yourself directing artillery fire. From a balloon, much less from an aircraft or a helicopter, without radio, What would you? How would it work? Couldn't work at all. So these are very, very big changes and advances. And it is, I think, probably. Well, there are many other ways, of course, in which advanced technology has had a big impact on tactics. But on a general, on command and control, the biggest changes have been in intercommunication through the development and the application of advanced technology. I mean, if you imagine Admiral Woodrow, whatever, what was his name in the Falklands, being able to talk to the First Sea Lord in London. Well, poor old Ian Hamilton couldn't talk to anybody except.
Did you in Gallipoli learn anything about your relationship with your men? Were there any lessons to be learned here?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think you always learn lessons that way. I mean, you get to know them better. You get to understand them. You get to understand their point of view. And to start with, you think it's got to be. You've got to agree with it, but later on, as time goes on, you realise you must understand their point of view, but not necessarily agree with it. or accept it. Yes, you get that's the whole thing, and you learn to talk to them to be able to communicate. In other words, I mean, it's just as one ordinary family social relationships with other human beings. I mean, it's like living in a village. It's like working in a company, in a business, learning to talk to people as you walk around the shop floor. I mean, some people will walk around the shop floor without saying a word to anybody, and there are other people who. I always make a point of when I was in business, if I was going around the shop floor, I'd break away from the sort of procession and talk to one or two individuals. And there's a marvellous story, which was one of Anthony Head's favourite stories, about Haig and talking to people. It's apparently, his star, Haig was very, they all were, those chaps. The Allenby, I suppose, was probably a little better than most, but none of them were really able to talk to their troops in a human sort of way. And the story about Haig is that his staff said to him one day, "You rarely say, when you inspect a regiment, you really must have a word with the one or two soldiers as you walk around the ranks." And the next time he visited, inspected the regiment, Haig stopped in front of one man and said, "Well, my man, and where did you start the war?" And the answer was, "I never started it, sir. I never said a word to anybody."
So it comes more easily to some than others, it would seem.
Much more easily to some than others. You'll find that in industry, in management. Some management managers can elicit. You've got to elicit the will to do what you want to do without recourse to the Army Act. That is something which you... perhaps in your nature, but you learn to apply it with experience. And some people much never learn.
Did you find yourself, in the First World War, that very few officers did have that contact with their men?
Well, not in my territorial battalion. No, I don't think so, because. Well, they weren't, you see, in the Territorial Army before the war, and still, the officers are not, they don't look upon themselves as a member of a corps of officers, as a class, or a group distinct from the men. I mean, they're either people from factories or professional things, and they're used to being with other people. They don't look upon themselves as, I don't know what the right word is, rather like, I mean, the German officer was in a class, the officer corps was a class, a group, distinct from the civil population. Well, the Territorial Army, you don't have that. And fortunately, gradually, in the regular British regular army, that has largely disappeared.
But during the First World War, in the regular army, generally think the gap between officers and men was quite?
Well, bad? I don't know enough about it. I never served in the regular unit in the First World War.
Now, I wonder if you came up against...
Well, I came up against staff officers, you know, who didn't really, yes. I think my stories about the generals who never visited the front and didn't visit their troops is indicative of that sort of separation between... I suppose it all derives from a sense of class consciousness or something. Well, you can belong to a class, but you don't need to be class conscious. That's what you want to say. I mean, I can talk to Sam, or I can talk to, I've got a corporal who drives me. I can talk to him when I feel like it, you know. When he feels like it, he talks to me. He tells me about his wife and his family, and we discuss military history. Things like that. I talked to my gardener in the same way. I talked to him about religion. Talking to him about religion a few years ago. I don't know what we were doing. We were working together on something. And he started talking about religion. And he said, I don't see how there's going to be room for everybody up there. So I said, well, you know, I know, that's his name. There are lots of things we don't understand. And then he said, and what about that ark? How could they possibly got all the animals in the world into one ark? And what did they do about fodder? Which is a typical countryman's outlook. So I said, well, you know, I think that's really allegorical. There was a long pause, and he said, well, yes, my lord, I suppose that's what you say, Ali, you know, no, what you said, Ali, sir. Very good. It's Monty, who taught the British Army how to talk to their troops, their men, and how to talk to the press and the media. All of it. If you see a young Lance Corporal in Ulster now being quizzed by somebody, by a member of the media, and you probably, you are, as I am, always very impressed by them, well, that all stems from, that all originates from teaching by Monty.
Yes, I must ask you a lot about that later on, because after all, he was one of your tutors, wasn't he?
Yes.
When you went to Staff College.
Yes, yes.
Yes, that's something I must take up with you later. Could I now ask you about the events after Gallipoli? What happened to you when you left on this ship? When, well, you know, the first part of the evacuation, it would
seem. We went to Egypt, and we were in camp, first of all, outside Alexandria, at a place called Sidi Bish, which was just a camp. You know, we did some training there, but mostly there wasn't any field training. And then we, I think it was from there that we went out to. Towards the Western Desert, when they thought there was an operation against the Senussi, and we went to we were a sort of backup brigade, and we were in camp there. We didn't take part in the operations. I think the operations were rather fizzled out. The Westminster Dragoons were involved. Duke of Westminster, with the very original armored cars, They were in that operation, and we were a sort of backup brigade, but we didn't actually take any active part in the operation.
Could you explain to me who the Senussi were and what they were doing at this particular time?
Well, the Senussi were the present-day Libyans. And the Libyans who lived in Libya, not in Tripoli. And they're the nomad tribes of the what now then I call the Western Desert, the area which is really Libya, which stretches from I suppose you could say it stretches from the Delta right through to the borders of Tripoli. And they're nomad tribes, and they were the king who Gaddafi deposed, or who was pushed out when Gaddafi took over Libya, he was the head of the Senussi. And that's what they were. They were Arab tribes. Whether they were all one tribe or different tribes or a collection of tribes, I'm not sure. But that's what they were. But they lived in Libya. And they, of course, had been occupied to some extent by the Italians. There were Italian settlements there.
And what sort of problem were they posing at that time, the Senussi?
I don't know.
But they were a nuisance.
I don't think they were. I wouldn't have said they were. They may have been being egged on by the Germans to try and do raids and things like that in the Delta. But I wouldn't have thought they were any serious threat at all. It was found necessary to attack them and that sort of thing, I don't really know.
What did you know about this armoured car squadron of the Duke of Westminster?
Well, nothing at all, except that they were there. I never saw them. And I never actually saw them, but they were operating out in front of us.
Was that rare to have an armoured, mobile division then?
As far as I know, there was no concept of having a an armoured or, well, there weren't any tanks, you see. Half a dozen tanks came out to Palestine later. I think, was it before? Yes, before the Battle of Megiddo. No, I don't think there was any idea of doing that then. I think the standard organization. Australian and New Zealand, the cavalry division and the Yeomanry division, of course, were back on horses then. I'm not quite sure, but certainly the Anzac Corps was mobile troops, but they were all on horses. No, there was no. I think the only mechanical, only mechanized troops were this armored car unit that the Duke of Westminster had. But I don't know. There were very, very elementary armored cars. They were in their first sort of birth, their early conception and birth then. But I never saw them. I don't know.
Did you actually get to see the pyramids while you were in Egypt?
Did I what?
Did you get to see the pyramids?
Yes, I got to see the pyramids. I got a photograph of myself below the and two of my brother officers sitting on camels below the Sphinx. And I got to know quite a lot about Egypt in those days. Yes.
Was this exciting for you as a young man to be in those foreign parts?
Yes, I think it was. Yes. Yes, I think so. I don't remember being particularly excited. I was interested, but I think probably we were more interested in the bright lights than we were in the history or the antiquities, I think probably.
This would be Cairo, I suppose, would it?
Yeah, in Cairo.
Yes, what
Cairo
was life like? You know, what was life like for a young officer on leave in Cairo?
Well, it was rather, it was good fun, you know. We were made, we used to go and have drinks in Shepherd's Bar. Shepherd's Bar was a sort of meeting place. And then you'd knock around the town, you'd go there, there were cafes and all that sort of thing. Well, and a lot of Nervous and Musky, where you went and you could get interesting things. But I wasn't really interested in buying carpets or antiques or anything like that in those days. That well, it passed me by. I was much more, I suppose, we kept pretty busy. I was much more interested in what I call the bright lights and the food and the drink. We went out, we went in, and later on we came back. And we're in camp, up facing, out in camp, facing the pyramids. There was a large camp area facing the pyramids, and we were there before we were doing training out in the desert, rather unimaginative and limited sort of training. And my only particular recollection of that time is we had an officer in the battalion, I think he was, or in the brigade anyway, who was an alpine climber, and he made a book on climbing to the top of the big pyramid within the time that the guides took. And it was a very difficult climb because the top of the big pyramid overhangs. It's the surfacing of the top is it overhangs the rest of it, and so we all took a bet in this book, or a lot of us did, and then we watched it all from our camp, and he did it. So he won our bet. No, but then I remember, that's all I really remember. We used to go racing. There were racing going on. We were allowed to go to Gazera, the sporting club there. We didn't play any organized games. But we weren't there very long before we went down to the canal.